If we want to improve the adult world and how people do empathize with that, we need to start by listening to kids when they're young. Twice exceptional refers to individuals who are both gifted, but they also have another disability layered on top of that. That might be autism. It could be dyslexia or dyscalculia. I don't know why, just because somebody is young, we dismiss what they say about their lived experience.
Yeah. I remember having panic attacks as early as like 7 in the middle of the night because I felt like I was the only person thinking about death.
Self-advocacy is key, helping kids recognize like what works for them. What is neurodiversity affirming for one person might be the opposite for somebody else.
Okay, welcome back everybody to another episode of Let's Talk Synesthesia. This episode was a long time coming because I was guest on their podcast a couple months back. It's Emily Kirchner-Morris from the Neurodiversity Podcast. Hi, Emily.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on my podcast after having me on yours. It was such a pleasure to be on yours, and I really just liked the outcome. I think we did a really good job of like having a synesthesia introduction on your podcast.
Yeah, I think so. I think people really appreciated it. It was kind of an angle related to neurodiversity that a lot of people hadn't heard of or knew a lot about. And so I think that's always interesting to kind of learn those new things.
It's also an episode that I like to send to people when they need like a brief introduction to the topic or to what I do, because that's what we usually don't have on our own podcast, right? It's like this big library of information. And yeah. So you are the host of the Neurodiversity Podcast, which if anybody listening doesn't know that podcast yet, please check it out. I listen to every episode, but in preparation to today's recording, I look back into like your library and your guests and you. You are an amazing podcast host. I think your podcast is amazing. I just wished to be as good as you. I think the topics and guests are fantastic. The one about suicide in neurodivergent folks, so important. LGBTQ and neurodivergent people, what a wonderful episode as well. So thank you so much for the work you do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be able to get in contact with interesting people and talk to them. And I always say, you know, Dave is my husband, but he does all the production work, which I feel like makes it sound really excellent as far as podcast production goes.
Oh yeah, definitely. He does a fantastic job. I need to get myself a production husband. Okay, Emily. So what do you do besides hosting a wonderful podcast? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So I actually started my career in education, and I actually taught both elementary education, but then I also taught in the States gifted education. So kids who have high ability, usually measured by IQ, that's in the 95th percentile or a little bit above. But there were a lot of unique social and emotional needs that those students had. So I went back and got a second master's degree in counseling. And so primarily right now, I work as a clinical mental health therapist, where I work with neurodivergent, gifted, and twice exceptional people and their families. And I've also written a couple of books. One of them is geared more for educators about teaching twice exceptional learners. I have a few for parents. And I have another book that will be coming out, honestly, in about a year. It's a little far off, but about creating neurodiversity affirming classrooms. So really just understanding, even beyond just gifted and twice exceptionality, what neurodivergent students need in the educational setting.
So you already used those words, giftedness and twice exceptional. Can you explain what those words mean?
Yes. So gifted and twice exceptional. So as I mentioned, giftedness really refers to that high ability based on IQ. And so usually it's rare that adults are usually given this label simply because most of the testing is primarily educational in nature, but it can be given. There are times that adults take IQ tests. There are organizations throughout the world, like Mensa, for example, that offer a sense of community and connection between individuals who are identified as gifted or talented or highly capable, lots of those different terms. Twice exceptional is a term that refers to individuals who are both gifted, so have this advanced ability to reason and solve problems, but they also have another disability layered on top of that. So that might be autism. It might be attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It could be dyslexia or dyscalculia. So there are a lot of different things. And sometimes there's more than one thing. You might hear people also use the term multi-exceptional. And so basically just recognizing, though, that when you have this ability coupled with this disability, it can cause a lot of difficulties because sometimes if one is identified and supported, the other one goes unrecognized. And that can be tricky in the school setting or in the workplace or just in life in general.
Yeah. Well, I can totally see that. So what we already know is giftedness looks different than what we used to think in the past. Like, giftedness doesn't mean those kids would necessarily do really well in school. Like, we already know that it is more complex than that. Not the quote-unquote smart kids in school were the gifted kids. It's a lot more difficult to understand the pattern of a gifted kid. Maybe you can speak a bit about that. What does the average profile of a kid, maybe a toddler, a teenager, or a young adult, what does the profile look like?
Yeah. So starting at a much younger age, individuals who are gifted, even at as toddlers, you can start to see some of those characteristics. So they might be early readers, they might speak very early, they're able to pick up math concepts and different things much earlier than their same age peers. And then as they get older in school, what you typically see is that they don't need as many repetitions to learn certain concepts. So they learn much more rapidly than their peers, and they can move through content very quickly. They also tend to make more connections and intuitive leaps about the content that they're learning. And so, again, that just kind of means that they're learning to understand those concepts at a faster pace than their peers. There are some other things that go along with this. So, gifted toddlers and children and even teens tend to have slightly more sensitive sensory systems. We're not talking about a significant hypo or hypersensitivity like you might see with somebody who is autistic, but you can see those differences where they're just more heightened with some of their awareness with some of those pieces. They tend to be very curious usually, but sometimes only about certain topics, and they really like to have deep dives that go into that. Through the teenage years, that kind of continues. And what ends up happening usually as gifted individuals reach adulthood is that hopefully they end up going into careers that hopefully are using their strengths where they are with other like-minded peers. One thing that often happens for kids and teens in the school setting is that they are in these mixed ability classrooms, which for many reasons is very good, but also it can be difficult because they do learn at a different pace, or they might not be able to find same age peers that really connect with them on the same level. And so those can be some of the difficulties. But usually as individuals reach adulthood and they enter a career that they're passionate about, they tend to be more with individuals who have similar abilities and interests. Not always, but you might see that where they can really leverage those strengths.
I can imagine that being gifted also, I don't know, can feel very lonely and like alienated if you're not in a surrounding where there's a lot of intellectual stimulation, where people maybe are not so drawn towards I don't know, gaining as much knowledge or just understanding a topic in the same depth or in the same sense. So I think it can also be quite lonely. Yeah. Is that an observation you made?
Yeah, definitely. So there is some research that shows that verbal ability specifically related to IQ is positively correlated with higher levels of just anxiety in general. So that is one piece. You know, you can break IQ or intelligence into that verbal ability, so the understanding and using of language, or there's also this what is called like perceptual reasoning or visual spatial reasoning, those types of things. And that one isn't closely as correlated with anxiety. But as far as connecting with peers, again, imagine just like that child who's in a classroom who is able to take in content much more quickly than their peers and work through the curriculum much faster. If you're in a social setting and you're talking with people about a topic, perhaps, and you know, if your brain is kind of making those connections faster than those peers, it can be harder to then carry on that conversation. And that is also influenced just by personality in general. But typically, people tend to seek out individuals who have not only similar interests, but similar ability levels, because when you process that information the same way, just as far as making a connection and feeling like you have that relationship, it makes a big difference just in feeling like you're having that social need fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be hard to find totally that because there's not as many people maybe who are out there who can connect at that same level.
Yeah, totally. And also it's not that obvious to yourself either, right? It's not like you think, oh, I just have a different level of ability in that area, and that's why I don't feel a sense of connection with the people that I click with on a different level. But people mm-hmm. that I consider to be my friends, but somehow it's not completely satisfying. And it takes a lot of education and self-awareness, I guess, to understand that I have a need and that can't be fulfilled by my family or the group of friends I have right now. So maybe later, like you said, in a job or university setting, that's a need that can be then fulfilled, which is really nice.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it just feels like you don't fit. And it's hard to really always recognize what that is.
Yeah.
But I will also say, for what it's worth, that ability is not the only thing that really is influenced with those social relationships. So for example, you may have, like, let's say you have a similar interest in a topic. Like if you know somebody who has just a very deep understanding of a topic, perhaps their ability overall, like their general ability is not in that gifted range, but that might be a really significant connection. And so sometimes that's a way that people can find those relationships to kind of ease that loneliness that they might experience, is by finding those peers who have similar fascinations or interests, like related to topic, rather than that overall ability.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. Now, I believe you work a lot with educators and teachers.
I do.
What can you tell us about how we can create a good environment in a classroom that would, I don't know, just be accommodating to different neurotypes, to different ability levels? It's a very complicated thing because one teacher for a whole classroom, it's never a simple answer, but I believe you probably made some observations and have a lot of experience in what is actually helpful.
Yeah, so it is interesting to kind of think about what schools can do. And, you know, on the surface, it seems like it should be easy. Like, you know, we'll just teach kids at the level that they learn at and move them along. But in general, like you mentioned, so many classrooms have so many different neurotypes, whether you're talking about giftedness or twice exceptional or just neurodivergent in general. And I guess the basic principle is really to look at the concept of universal design and recognizing that the tools that we put in place that are good for kids who learn and think differently are good for all kids. So that might mean for your high ability learners that you are working to challenge them and move them through the curriculum more quickly. So for example, they might take a pretest before they go into a unit of study. And if they've already mastered that content, then they do something that's has greater depth and complexity. Or it might be moving them grade levels, you know, if, in math, like maybe they're ready to go up and they don't have to stay with their same grade peers in order to be more challenged in that area. But it can also be things as simple as providing other types of accommodations, again, for kids maybe who are ADHD or autistic, who maybe struggle with executive functioning skills. Like if we can put systems in place in the classrooms that are supportive for those students and kind of help them, we can make the curriculum more accessible. But it is really difficult because the curriculum is created with the middle part of the student body in mind. And so when you have children who have these diverse abilities or struggles, it can be very difficult for them to find the right fit.
So difficult. And if I only think about like one accommodation that would work for every student, I can't think of any. Like, I don't know, right. There might be a ADHD kid that can focus better when there's music in the background. And then a kid with synesthesia would completely freak out or just be completely, you know, distracted because they would see colors during the test. Like, I had a podcast guest who said that she had to take exams in this weird school where they had music in the background. And she was so distracted that instead of answering the questions, she would just paint or like draw all over the paper. So there really isn't like a good solution for the whole classroom. Like, there will always be an accommodation that helps yet one person but is the completely wrong thing for the other person.
Yeah, that's true. And I think I'm encouraged by people who are learning more about themselves and learning to self-advocate and recognizing what their needs are. And also I think technology is really helpful as far as providing some ways to kind of really meet the unique needs of students. But when we talk about creating neurodiversity affirming environments, you're absolutely right that what is neurodiversity affirming for one person might be the opposite for somebody else. And that can be really hard. You know, it's kind of this constant balancing act of trying to figure out like what is going to help the most people without having a negative effect on others, you know, and that can really vary. But I think also it's important to recognize, like, first of all, my thought would be like with the example that you were giving, rather than playing music for an entire classroom, students who benefit from that could use headphones. Vice versa, you know, the student who is experiencing the music as colors in their mind and can't focus, they could potentially also use headphones to cancel that out. My thought would be like, rather than adding something to the environment for everybody and then having somebody else take it out, just let the people who need it add it, if that makes sense.
Completely,
Yeah, but I think it just goes back to that thing that I mentioned at the very beginning of my response to this, which is self-advocacy is key, helping kids and people in general recognize like what works for them is really important, because then they can speak up and say, I can't focus on this test, you know, or whatever that might be. And then being able to negotiate and find a solution that is compatible for all of the people in that environment.
One thing that, and I think you are the perfect person to speak to about this, is I have this strong perception that we don't believe kids enough. Everything they like say is either not like relevant or really adorable, and I'm like, this is such a important piece of information. It might be in a childlike language, obviously, because it's a child, but it's such important information that this child has just given me, like, and it can be something like I don't want to be touched, or just a body language of I don't want to be touched, that's like, from an adult, you would just take that way more seriously than we take it from kids. And I think that's so, I don't know, it feels just very disrespectful to observe that kind of behavior.
I totally agree. Yeah, I don't know why, just because somebody is young, we dismiss what they say about their lived experience. Yeah. And but you're right, we do. Or we think that we know better, like that they should just, you know, push through that or ignore that, or that can't be that big a deal. And I think sometimes, to some extent, adults do it as well. I think we're just really, in general, poor at empathizing with people who experience the world differently than we do. I think many neurodivergent adults experience that in general. Like, they recognize, like, I'm telling you, this is how I am experiencing this, and you're dismissing it. But I think kids in general, neurodivergent or not, really experience that. And what's interesting is, like, when you think about it, if we want to improve the adult world and how people do empathize with that, we need to start by listening to kids when they're young, because we treat kids. So we think about different sensory needs in general. We teach children at an extremely young age to ignore the needs that their body tells them they have. I need to go to the bathroom. Sorry, we'll take a bathroom break in 15 minutes. You know, I need to go get a drink of water. Nope, now's not the time to get a drink of water.
Yeah. And or then, you need to finish that plate of food.
Right. Yes. Yes. All of these things. And when we do that, what kids learn is that they shouldn't listen to themselves, and therefore that other people shouldn't listen to themselves either. And it's amazing to me that this is the system that we have set up for students, because it just doesn't really make sense. But what happens, though, is, like, all of that sensory input is so vital to our emotional regulation skills. And if you want somebody to grow into a person who is able to maturely regulate their emotions and be aware of that and self-advocate, all of these things, it starts at such a young age, which is just what you're talking about honoring and understanding and listening to what kids tell you their experiences are.
And respected.
Yes.
This just reminded me of, during my studies, I did another, like, external course to become a child relaxation trainer.
Oh.
It was a cool course. It was really interesting. But what you just said reminded me of, like, the first session we had, where the teacher said, this is not a course to teach kids how to relax. This is a course to help kids not lose the ability to relax, because they have it. Like, you know, it's different. It's a different perspective. Like, adults have to relearn a lot of stuff, but we're talking about young kids and we want them to get even better. Or... make time for it, or understand this is relaxation. But it's not like they don't know what it is. They don't know how it feels. They do know how it feels.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that is, I think that would be a fascinating class to take. And for teachers as well, just to kind of, like, understand. I mean, you know, anyone who works with kids or teens, whatever their role might be, whether they're a coach or a teacher or a therapist or whatever it might be, ultimately they are teaching kids how to be in the world, right? And it's like, the more we can recognize that, you know, those lessons just stick with kids as they get older. And so being able to recognize, like, how to help kids keep some of that autonomy that they have, as opposed to always feeling like they have to comply or fit in or push through or whatever that might be, could be really valuable.
Yeah, I completely agree. I have one other question, and I think it's a bit more, like, selfish because it really interests me, and I'm not sure how big of a deal it is actually in your work. But did you observe any, like, giftedness to existential thoughts pipeline kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Okay, you're nodding already. I want to hear more because that is my life.
Yes. So one thing that happens frequently, let me start here. So children typically understand existential concepts such as the universality of death, the permanence of death, you know, those types of ideas, usually by about the time they're like maybe say 10 or 11, that really becomes very concrete for them. They really understand what that means. But for children with high ability, they understand those concepts at a much younger age, but they also don't have the life experience to put that into context. And so they think about those questions much earlier and in a much deeper way than some of their peers do. So that can cause a lot of frustration and difficulty. I mean, we actually have a podcast episode that's getting ready to come out here in the next few weeks where I speak with a parent of a profoundly gifted child. And this child, when he was like age 4 and 5, was asking questions about, how do I know that I'm real? How do I know that I actually exist? How do I, you know, what, and those are questions, honestly, that sometimes adults don't even really consider. But when you have that ability to make those connections, it can be really tricky. But then if you can't make meaning from it, if you can't find the relevance to your own life or the connection to the universe or whatever that might be for you, it can slip into some of that existential depression where you're just kind of uncertain about purpose and you know, where things are going. And you know, I mean, I remember working with a student who was having a lot of these questions. This was, you know, in my mental health practice. And, you know, he was gifted and probably twice exceptional, although he didn't have that label at the time. But he was in second grade and he just was going, you know, if life is this hard now, how am I ever going to get through my adulthood? Because I just don't know how it'll ever get any easier. And he couldn't put that into perspective. And it was heartbreaking because as adults, we're able to kind of define our sense of purpose a little bit more. That's hard for a child to do. And a lot of times kids don't feel like they can even talk about it. And so, but that's something to kind of be on alert for if you're working with or supporting or raising, you know, a gifted child.
I had goosebumps when you just explained all of that. And I don't want to make it too much about myself, but it's such an issue, or it was such a big issue for me growing up, not getting answers to those existential questions of like, why do we exist? What is death? What happens after death? Like, I remember having panic attacks as early as like 7 in the middle of the night because I felt like I was the only person thinking about death. And it was just nothing my family was really concerned about in their day to day. Like, they are very much in the, you know, they're mindful, I would say. Like, they're not spacing away in like thinking about the universe. Like, when my mom would look, when she would look at the sky full of stars, she would say, this is so beautiful. This is so romantic. And I would be like, I don't want to talk about it. This is the scariest thing I have ever seen. How can you look at this and not be terrified? We are on a floating blue ball and I don't understand it.
Yeah.
So that's my childhood. Lovely parents, yeah, but they didn't have the same desire to or need to answer those questions. And I felt so incredibly alone with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think those are questions that are hard to verbalize in general. But especially, like, you're not going to go out to the playground and talk to your friends about that.
No.
But it's very real. It's very real. I remember, yeah, just from my own childhood, some of that questioning at a really young age, too. You know, I remember sitting in Sunday school specifically and just going, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, you know,
church.
Yes. And I was just like, I'm like, so tell me again how this makes sense, because I needed the logic. Like, I needed I needed it to like fit all together. And I think in general, a lot of gifted individuals just have a lot of those existential questions, even through adulthood. Yeah. And I will just say, even now as an adult, there are times when I think to myself, gosh, it would be wonderful to really feel like I really felt like I had an answer to all of those questions. But I just, you know, it's too big, but I feel like there must be something peaceful about that. But that's not always, I don't know, it's easier said than done.
Totally. The idea of not even raising those questions in your head sounds kind of peaceful to me. And having answers to the questions can also be peaceful. It depends on what the answer is. But that middle ground where you constantly question things and it really impacts how you go about life, because if nothing is important, because everything will end and evaporate or whatever.
Yeah.
It really changes your perspective on life for the good and bad, I would say.
Yeah. When I talk with clients who are dealing with these existential questions, which happens relatively often, the way that I try to put it in perspective for them is that it can feel really overwhelming when you zoom out too far. Like you were mentioned, when you were looking at the stars, and like when you think about the universe in general, and we're just this little tiny piece of it. But the way I kind of end up rationalizing it, I don't know if rationalizing it is the right way to put it, but the way I kind of end up conceptualizing it is like, once you zoom out too far and it feels like, quote unquote, nothing matters.
Yeah.
When you zoom back in on what your daily life is, you're able to kind of think, well, then I get to decide. Like I get to decide based on my values and my experience, the things that I want to focus on about what meaning my life has. And that can be really empowering. But if you feel helpless and just kind of adrift, then it's hard to just even go about your day-to-day interactions, you know, if that's what's in the back of your mind.
It just leads to that existential depression that you spoke about earlier, because really there isn't really much that makes sense anymore if you zoom out too far. And I mean that very literal, like Google Maps, Google Earth, zooming out, like just don't do it. it can be such a visual representation of the thoughts you already have in your head. I find it very terrifying when that.
Yeah. No, I can understand that.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. I'm really, really glad to hear that. I mean, I already suspected it, but I really wanted to hear your perspective on it, because that's really the clients you work with. But I know that if I would work with a child that would have the same questions that I had, I think one major thing would be to tell them, you're not the first person that thought about that. You know, there are books about it, there are documentaries, there are philosophies. There's so much that tries to explain this. You're not alone with it. And once you're old enough, we can tackle all those topics together and look at it, because that was what was missing for myself specifically. Like, I think I even felt superior in that regard. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I really felt like, well, I'm the only person that understands this.
Yeah. And why doesn't anyone else see it this way?
Yeah.
Like, what's wrong that they don't understand what I'm trying to share?
And I think it even plays into what I said earlier about respecting and listening to kids, because often when I said those things like, why is the world round? It would be a funny thing to adults.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was said by a child.
Yeah,
and like maybe it was said in a funny tone, or I don't know. We just find things kids say funny very easily, because their kids are funny and cute. But it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny for me. It was like, sorry, I have this kid-like voice, but I'm onto something here, and I need a good counterpart.
Yeah, I have a real question.
Yeah,
here.
Good counterpart for this conversation.
You know, anyone who is maybe raising a gifted child, or, you know, educating one, or is a grown-up gifted kid themselves, you can recognize how much value there is in listening and being able to say to a child, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Let's go find out. Or gosh, I never thought about it that way. Like just validating the thought process of my three children. They're 15, 13, and 8, but my 8-year-old is the one who has most of those existential questions, and thinks about death more than the others. You know, it's hard to then also even respond to those, you know, other than just say, yeah, it's scary to kind of think about it, you know, and here's, you know, but let's see what we can kind of figure out together, or let's just talk about like what we think it might be. But having that feeling of just not being alone with those questions is really powerful.
So powerful, so needed. Like if that goes well, such a good base for your resilience and mental health in later life.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay. To leave the existential thoughts behind for today and to leave on a more positive note. The other question I have
for
you.
Everyone's going to leave the episode and go, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Or they feel really understood.
Yes.
So I want to hear a bit more about your experience working with educators in school. But one question I have before that is, because you said the other kid was profoundly gifted. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can just look at the theory, like the concept of IQ. Mm-hmm. Do we still use IQ points? Is that the main criteria? What can you tell us about that?
Well, here in the U.S., at least, it really varies based on a particular school and their identification process. Sometimes they look more like achievement, which achievement and ability are slightly different. So ability is based on IQ, and it has to do with like problem solving and what we would expect somebody to be able to do. Achievement is what they have already mastered. And so sometimes when they're identifying kids in schools, they look more at achievement. Like what are you reading several grade levels ahead? Are you, you know, looking at math scores, whatever that might be. But in general, IQ tends to be at least one of the ingredients that is used for identifying students in school. Now, from a psychological perspective, as opposed to an educational one, usually the IQ is the measure that is most typically referred to. And so when you talk about that bell curve, 100 is an average IQ score. So that's the 50th percentile, meaning that half of the people in the world have an IQ of 100 and above, and then the other half are 100 and below, and that's kind of the midpoint there. And something like, I think, 68% of people have an IQ somewhere between 90 to 110. So that's kind of that middle portion. When we get out to those tail ends of the bell curve, an IQ of 130 is the 98th percentile. And that is what is considered two standard deviations above the norm. And so that's usually a pretty general cutoff for identifying giftedness. I think most, like I mentioned Mensa earlier, like I think that might be their cutoff, but I don't know off the top of my head. I could be wrong. And then beyond that, so like a 145 then would be three standard deviations above the norm, and that's like a 99.8 percentile, I believe, off the top of my head. So you can see how, like, as you get up to those higher numbers, there's just fewer and fewer people that really kind of fall into those categories.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And the labels that would go with these segments, let's say, are, I think, mildly gifted, gifted, profoundly gifted. I think those are the labels used, right?
It kind of depends on what you're using as your source. Different sources call it different things. So yeah, there's like mild, moderate, highly, exceptionally, profoundly, and that kind of goes in order, but not all of them use all of those terms. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that I don't always know how useful those designations are. Sometimes they are, especially when you're talking about somebody who is, like I mentioned, this child who I mentioned earlier, who is profoundly gifted, who is composing music at age 3 and took the the advanced, do you know advanced placement courses? Is that? I don't know if that's just in the US.
I don't know what that is.
So basically they're high school level courses that, but you can test out of them and you can get college credit while you're in high school. And he took the AP music theory when he was like 6 years old and scored a 5 on it. Like this is a college level, like, and there are just very, very few individuals who really are that gifted in those areas. Right. So it definitely is influenced. But then again, going back to that piece about that twice exceptionality, that really influences things as well, where you might have somebody who has very high ability, but they really struggle with, social relationships or organization and executive functioning. And then that can then impact how that giftedness manifests in their day-to-day life.
Totally. And then also for an autistic person, it's often more, they often have a very good ability in one field, but are average in another one. And
I would say in general, any type of neurodivergent person that's related to learning, whether it's dyslexia, dyscalculia, giftedness, autism, ADHD, whatever, you have those really spiky profiles where they might have some skills that are really above average and then some that are lower, even with gifted individuals. Like rarely do you see that ability the same across the board because it is so statistically unlikely to have those high abilities in all of those areas. So that is something that kind of is influenced.
So for a neurotypical child, it would just be a lot of like abilities to the same level in more fields.
Yes.
That's kind of what we're speaking here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, just one little tidbit about autism in general too, which I find fascinating is that research shows that individuals who are identified as autistic are 1.5 times more likely than others to also be cognitively gifted. So when you look at a population of gifted individuals, there's a much higher proportion of them who are also autistic than you would see in the general population, which I find fascinating. And also to recognize that there are many autistic individuals who we are unable to really measure their intelligence because of the barriers with language or motor skills. And so that number may be even higher. We just don't have a great way of measuring that ability. But, I find that really fascinating, and just recognizing that so many neurodivergent people don't have their abilities fostered and supported as much as they could.
Yeah, totally. Completely agree. Well, thank you so, so much, Emily. That was such helpful information, such good insight into working with neurodivergent children, giftedness, existential thoughts, all the things, so, so helpful. Thank you so, so much. Is there anything you would want to let our listeners know? What's your mission? What's something you really deeply care about in your work?
Our mission is to create a neurodiversity affirming world. So whatever that means for individuals, finding ways that they can live their authentic lives. And that really is the purpose of all of the work that I do, whether it's in the mental health practice or through the podcast or through the books and the speaking, all of those things. That really is the vision.
Thank you so, so much, Emily. Sending love to the States and all the best.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk Synesthesia. There'll be a new episode of Series 1 every Tuesday. If you enjoyed listening, you can like, follow, and share. Details about the podcast and how to connect with today's speakers can be found in the show notes. The executive producer was Micah Pricing, with music by Corinne Anderson, and the podcast was supported by a couple more neurodivergent people in the background. See you next week.